we're going to take a little broader look at the whole arms control and defense area than we have in the past. We're able to do so because profit is not without honor, but somehow Bob O'Connell over recent days has become very visible on the American intellectual scholarly scene. His book of Arms and Men has not only attracted a lot of publicity and notice for its quality and its character, alternate book of the month selection, selection by a number of book clubs, history book club, other clubs, as their selection of the month. But in addition, the reviews have been uniformly favorable, Los Angeles Times, all the leading outlets. It's reminiscent a little bit of the attention which a friend of many of you in this room got when Quincy Wright published The Study of War many, many years back. He had a whole retinue of graduate assistants, I gather. Bob O'Connell has worked as a lonely scholar, but with some institutional help, but essentially as an individual researcher. Bob received his bachelor's from Cornell, his master's and PhD from the University of Virginia in history. He is teaching in the history faculty now. He's been an intelligence analyst for FSCC. Who can in the room can say what the initials mean?
You want to. Science and technology.
Right. It's here, and we all know that it's here, but the Foreign Science and Technology Center is a major center for research on foreign areas and on science problems. He was detailed for 3 years to ACTA and attended the Conference on Disarmament as an advisor and participant from 1985 through 1986. He's a contributing editor to the Quarterly Journal of Military History and is a participant in organizing a possible conference on the subject, Is War Dead?, which may be held sometime later this year. So it's nice when somebody is 1,000 miles away that they visit Charlottesville. It's even nicer when they're close at hand and have been a participant in other Miller Center activities to find this kind of success and achievement in one's midst. So very pleased to have you with us.
Well, thank you very, very much, and thank you all for coming this morning. What I'd like to talk about with you is essentially military history and why one might study such an area. I remember I was at a dinner party a couple of years ago, and an older woman was, we were next to one another, and she turned to me finally, and I told her what I was doing, and she said, "Young man, why in God's name would anyone want to study military history?" And the only thing I could think of to tell her, well, it's certainly not to make money. And outside of that, I was at a loss. So I thought for a while about that question, and I thought of two potential areas, and I'd like to talk to you about those two areas this morning. The first of these is one of the things that our government characteristically does, and we do a lot of, and we spend an enormous amount of money on, and that's we buy weapons. We equip a very large military structure with, I guess you could say, death machinery. And we have done that for a long time, and it's one of the areas that, at the moment, we probably, one of the relatively few areas, we're still clearly lead technologically. The second thing that we might want to understand about in terms of the perspective that military history might provide is what, in fact, we might do with these weapons. Not only how we configure them, but of what use might they be to us in preserving our security. Military history is a fairly underdeveloped field. It began as basically virtually the only kind of history, political and military history, that was it. If you look at the ancients, Thucydides, Herodotus, Polybius, Aelian, all the major ancient historians, what they essentially wrote about was war, because it struck them as one of the most important activities that men undertook, and unquestionably the most dramatic. This, for a variety of reasons, has changed, and much of this is healthy. Beginning of the 20th century, probably, there was much more interest taken in social history, a variety of kinds. Political history was somewhat de-emphasized, partially because there was development of an entirely new field, political science, which examined much of this. Military history, on the other hand, tended to be gradually de-emphasized to the point of almost disappearing. This reached more or less of a culmination shortly after the Vietnam War, when out of really several thousand American colleges and universities, military history was a tenure-track position in only 24 of them. There are a variety of reasons for this. Military history is not perceived as a particularly humane activity. Military affairs have been largely, one would almost say historically, almost exclusively, the domain of men. There are reasons for this, and I would argue there are actually socio-biological reasons for this. But nonetheless, in an environment of rising feminine consciousness and a great deal more interest in the history of women, once again, military history was perceived as really almost the province of a sort of group of sexists. And this is not entirely untrue. Almost virtually all military historians have been men, with a possible exception, with a very notable exception of Barbara Tuchman, who wrote a wonderful history, The Guns of August. But in general, and now I guess Antonine Fraser, this book she's just written, but in general, this has been the case. Finally, the dominance of social history and in general, the feelings that intellectual historians and historians and intellectuals in general felt about the Vietnam War, that they simply wanted to forget military affairs. Of these things, probably the least popular subject was weapons. This was something that was absolutely considered deplorable to study. Unfortunately, it remains important. And it's my contention that one of the problems when I wasn't involved in arms control, one of the things I quickly realized is that there's very little real knowledge about weapons beyond that which is polemical. One hears the same sort of things that the Romans were saying in the halls of power today. Well, that's not necessarily bad, but certainly our situation has changed dramatically, and the awesome power of these weapons has increased in such a remarkable fashion that it strikes me that it will be important to study this as an academic discipline in a much more rigorous and methodical fashion than we've been doing. One of the examples I like to give is up until the morning of December 7th, 1941, which after all is only 48 years ago, less than a half a century ago, the deterrent, the key weapon of deterrence was the dreadnought battleship, which is a really very archaic weapon. And now we live in an era of fantastic weaponry that could literally, if this country became involved in a full-scale nuclear exchange, it is quite literally true that the infrastructure of this country could be wrecked in an afternoon. And I don't think that's any exaggeration. People say, well, you know, all life on Earth could be ruined. That's highly problematical. But I think we can say that the infrastructure could be wrecked in an afternoon. So this is important. These are important matters. And the essence of what I wrote about in this book had to do with why people choose one weapon over another. Now, this is an important subject in particular because it's generally argued on a very narrow range of choice. In Congress, when weapons are proposed by the Defense Department and congressional hearings are held, the two essential issues that are raised have to do with economics and the effectiveness of those weapons. How much do they cost? How many people will be involved using them? And how lethal are they? Well, I think that this perspective is quite unfortunate, but it's difficult to get around. For example, if an admiral came before Congress and said, the reason I like that big ship I want is because when I'm up on the bridge and I'm driving that sucker around, boy, I feel powerful. He would literally, that would be the end of his military career. However, when one looks at the history of arms, one finds that this is one of the essential paradigms by which weapons are developed. In the West, at least, which is primarily what this book examines, weapons have been preferred which have been large, fast, armor-plated, loud, and fierce-looking. A good example of this, a perfect example of this in many ways, is the dreadnought battleship, which is my personal favorite weapon. I always hope somebody would leave me one in their will or something like that. A fun ship. But the point of this is that if one thinks about weapons in general, and one takes, for instance, the battleship, which is a fantastically popular weapon. To give you an example, most weapons, when they're judged obsolete, are simply destroyed and eliminated. Not the dreadnoughts; they were put in mothballs. And in fact, at the first opportunity, they were brought out of mothballs, and now we have dreadnoughts again. Not only we, but the Russians went so far as to resurrect a class of battleship, the battle cruiser, which had essentially reached a dead end in terms of naval construction after World War I. Yet recently they built two new battle cruisers. So this is a worldwide phenomenon, and I would argue that again is one of the central paradigms that we should think about in terms of weapons. Although the Russians' attitudes towards military affairs and their attitudes towards how people should be treated in battle, that kind of thing, may very well differ from ours. Their attitudes towards weapons are essentially the same. And in fact, although the emphasis is different, you will find virtually every weapon in the U.S. arsenal with an analog in the Soviet arsenal. Well, let's take two examples then. Let's take Achilles, and the Dreadnought Battleship. Well, I think you can see they're both loud. Achilles was, and Homer refers to Achilles shouting on the battlefield and terrorizing everybody. They're fast. Achilles, they have a kind of a track meet in the middle of the Iliad, and Achilles wins. He's armor plated, and he loses his friend Patroclus borrows his armor to get killed by Hector, and he has to go through a long rigmarole where the god Hephaestus builds him some new armor. He's extraordinarily confronted. He goes around the battlefield basically telling people he's going to kill them before he does kill them. And in many ways, he personifies very much the same characteristics as the Dreadnought. Now, if we carry that one step farther, I think we can see some of the analogies and the utility of this. If we remember Caspar Weinberger's little model that he liked to wave before Congress, what this little model was a series of intercontinental ballistic missiles. And at one end, on the right, appropriately enough, were the American missiles. They were little tiny things, little Minutemen and little Polaris's, and then maybe a little bit bigger MX. And then we had the gigantic Russian missiles, the SS-17, 18, and 19. The 18s especially being extraordinarily large. Well, throw weight does make a difference. But what made this model so impressive was the fact that you look at these things and you say, oh my God, the Russian, they're so much bigger. You know, they must be more powerful. Now, on the other hand, weapons that tend to be of the opposite ilk, small, sneaky, perhaps even invisible, tend not to be favored by the military establishment and in people in general, because I don't think, when you look at this closely, I don't think you find that the establishment's views, the military man's views, necessarily differ that much from individual citizens' views of weapons. This is something that's fairly deep in our culture. One of the good example of this is the problems that the submarine had being integrated into a force structure. Here's a weapon that it was again sneaky. It hid beneath the surface of the water. Miserable to serve on, you couldn't march around. If you tried to wear a white uniform in a submarine, it just got all dirty and the acid ate holes in it. It was not armor plated, it was very delicate. It was not particularly fast, and submarines only got more popular when they got nuclear propulsion, so they could become more fast. And I think the attitude towards the submarine was epitomized in a naval war game that the Royal Navy staged shortly before World War I, in which a young submariner put three torpedoes into the side of a battleship. Torpedoes. What happens often when you hit these practice torpedoes is that the torpedo, because it's powered, it will hit the submarine and bounce off and hit it again and hit the battleship again and again. So you have this sort of bong, bong, bong. Well, anyway, he did this three times, and finally he emerged and surfaced and sent up some flags suggesting that this battleship might want to take itself out of the action. And the flags returned by the battleship said, "Young man, you be damned." Well, the point of all of this is that these characteristics, we remain human beings. We remain a culture of human beings. Much of what warfare is about, and the military profession is a very traditional profession. It carries with it a great deal of culture. Much of that remains, and I would argue that these are not necessarily anachronistic judgments. The admiral who said, "Young man, you be damned," was not only expressing a certain amount of anger at insubordination and perhaps a conservative, even purblind attitude towards towards new weaponry. But he was also arguing that basically, if war comes, that human beings should try to remain somewhat civilized. They should not kill promiscuously. And to him, the submarine symbolized that kind of promiscuous killing. It's one of the reasons, and I think this is an important judgment, because I think the United States, it's generally agreed from a historical standpoint, that the primary reason the United States entered World War I was because of the unrestricted submarine campaign. But when you look at the number of people killed in that campaign, which is around 17,000 for the entire war, and then you look at the horrible carnage on the Western Front, where you have a line, two armies laying siege to one another for four long years, and over 10 million men dying in combat, in a space not much bigger from Crozet, width not much bigger from Crozet to Keswick, and stretching like a giant lethal snake across Europe. I think you could say that these cultural factors must have been fairly powerful, because it wasn't that carnage on the Western Front that so angered Woodrow Wilson and the American people. It was the unrestricted submarine warfare. Now, what am I arguing for then? I'm certainly not arguing that these factors necessarily should dominate weapons development. But I think we need to take them into account. I think we need to think about these factors, because they have an impact. Admirals, for instance, why, in fact, do they like carrier task forces? Certainly they're useful in projecting power. But also, they do reflect this long heritage of the capital ship mentality. Now, these carrier task forces are extraordinarily expensive. You're talking perhaps $4 billion for the carrier itself, another $500 million for the planes it carries. Destroyers these days, an Aegis-class destroyer is running at least $1 billion. You need several of those. You need some frigates. You need possibly a cruiser or two, $2.5 billion. You can run through, as Hubert Humphrey was fond of saying, a billion here, a billion there. First thing you know, you're talking about serious money. You can run through $15 billion for a carrier task force. So we should think, why are we buying these things? Another example is obviously the fiasco with the B-1 bomber. Those 100 planes have cost the U.S. government now $27 billion. They're grounded. They're not a part of our defense structure now. They don't work. And they've been grounded lately for purely mechanical reasons. They haven't gotten even involved in the penetration problems they have. They, in fact, cannot penetrate Russian air defenses, as far as we know. Basically, they're still useful as cruise missile carriers, as standoff bombers. But the B-52s could do that role. Or a 747. We didn't necessarily need to build that plane. But the Air Force likes the idea of manned bombers. And there are a variety of fairly good reasons for that. One thing, unlike a ballistic missile, you set it off, you can't bring it back. You can turn a manned bomber around. So it's a fairly secure deterrent in that regard. But again, how much are you going to pay for that? And I think it's important to keep that in mind and to keep some of the factors. Why, in fact, does the Air Force want and feel they need these planes? And obviously the B-2 is a good example. There we're going after a system that will potentially cost close to $100 billion. This is a lot of money. Finally, good example. On the other side of the fence is the Russian armies being wedded to the tank. It's very interesting that the political leadership has moved directly to eliminate tanks. Well, this sends a message, obviously, to the NATO allies that we want to make our force structure look less offensive. But it also sends a message to the Russian military that we're not necessarily happy with you guys. You've spent a lot of money in many ways. You've militarized our country. And here, we're going to cut the very weapon that you perceive as the most important, which is the tank, ironically, in this age of nuclear weapons, remains the sort of national weapon of the Soviet Union. Finally, I'd like to finish up by talking a bit about another subject which I'm interested in, and that is, okay, you apply some of these factors to buying weapons. Why would you want to use these weapons? Would you want to use these weapons? In fact, will they be used to fight with? I would argue probably not. It's my contention, and I think it's quite a controversial one, that war as a significant institution, and it was a very significant institution, is essentially dead in the industrialized world. If we do end up fighting another major war, it seems to me that the chances are very strong that it will escalate to the point that the destruction that will flow from it will essentially break the back of Western civilization. It's perhaps true that there will be survivors and they will build upon the rubble. But I think it's safe to say that Western civilization will not be the course they necessarily take. There's an interesting and I think quite influential book that's just been written by a fellow named John Mueller, just recently reviewed in the Post by George Bundy, called Retreat from Doomsday, in which Mueller argues that war is dead for many of the same reasons that dueling is dead. People just decided it was a silly pursuit, and they're not going to do that anymore. My feeling, although I certainly admire Mueller's courage, I essentially agree with his conclusions, it seems to me that he sort of belongs to the sort of just say no school of history. And that, in fact, war has a much more fundamental basis in Western civilization. And if one is out to prove that war is dead, it's necessary to understand its institutional strengths and look at those in terms of contemporary society. Now, organization, structure, and institutions are often best studied at their origins because their causes are perhaps most nascent. And I think that one of the ways that we can get at understanding war is to study its origins. And that will, in fact, be my next book, I hope, will be to study the origins of war and try to explain why it came about and therefore what was involved and why then it may not be a viable institution today. I looked in the Alderman has this wonderful new system, the Virgo system, and I looked under origins of war. There's been one book written on this subject since 1980, which is remarkable. Again, I think this is an important area and one that simply isn't emphasized. Anthropologists have gotten into this some, and they've done some fairly good work, but unfortunately one of the problems with anthropologists is they don't care about the institution of war. They simply care about why people might fight some form of, might engage in some form of lethal aggression. But war is very special. War has institutional causes. I would argue that at the essence of war is agriculture, and that war remains a very viable institution right up until the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And that's when you begin to see its breakdown. Civilization, when urbanization first comes upon us, one of the things you immediately have is you have a much more productive agricultural base, which allows for a rapid expansion of populations. This happened several times. One of the most remarkable anthropological facts I've ever come across is that civilization has developed in perhaps three places virtually independent from one another, or as far as people know. Yet what evolved looked almost alike. And this almost, when one thinks about the metaphor for civilization, one would almost think that it occupies some sort of ecological niche. But anyway, to get back to my point, as populations expanded, they were dependent on essentially this agriculture to support them. Well, over the long term, that was fine, but over the short term, agriculture could be quite unstable. And if your crops fail for even a year, a large number of people were going to die. Another thing that happened when people began living in close contact with one another is epidemic disease for the first time became a major factor. What I think happened was that civilization in many ways developed an intense but almost neurotic social state, social psychological state. That when one looks at these civilizations, early civilizations, over and over again, one sees a preoccupation with death. And war provides not only an outlet for this, but a general safety valve. A way, well, if our crops fail, or we think they might fail, if we can only gather more land and get bigger. All of these factors begin to leave us with the Industrial Revolution. Agriculture gets much more steadily productive. There are alternative means of getting a living. Communication and transportation allows, if your crops fail, you can always buy somebody else's crops fail. One of the most overtly hostile things one can do in such an environment would be to cut off somebody's food supply. Yet when the Russians invaded Afghanistan and we created a grain embargo, Russians simply shrugged their shoulders and bought grain from somebody else. Epidemic disease begins to come under control. And finally, the key factor is weapons become so much more deadly that it begins to become impossible to fight. So I would argue that we find ourselves at a point now where, at least in the industrialized world, war as an institution is pretty much over, and that we need to begin to think about this, think about how we will exist in a world without war, but perhaps with a war, a very well-armed world without war, because I don't think any of this will necessarily lead to universal disarmament. But again, I think that military history could perform a useful function by documenting some of this and raising these points and opening them for some more debate, because unfortunately we don't talk or think about this enough. The University of Virginia is a good example that we've had no military historian here for 50 years. And I think that the interest in these subjects are growing, but I think that we need not only opinion. Too much is believed and too little is known. I think we need real knowledge and real scholarship. And on that note, if anyone wants to ask any questions.
Bob, could I ask an opening question and take advantage of where I'm sitting? What about cultural lag? What about attitudes that may continue even though reality has changed? An example, I would think, would be Hitler's Lebensraum appeal. We have to have the breadbasket of Europe.
All right. Cultural lag is an interesting phenomenon and an important one, although I would argue less so. A good example, I think, of this is the invention of the gun. I used to go around to European military museums because I was interested in studying armor and how it developed, and it got a lot thicker after the development of the gun. About 1560, I began noticing an interesting phenomenon in European armor. There were these little holes in it. And I thought they were kind of places for rivets and stuff. And finally it struck me what those things were. They were bullet holes. And essentially the phenomenology associated with fighting in a pre-gun environment, in West at least, was that you get in as close as possible to the other guy. A good example of this again is the Iliad, where all the characters continually talk about, you know, I'm a real man, I fight close, fight in close. And essentially, if anybody comes to be considered a villain in the Iliad, it's probably Paris who fights in steel talon and fights with a bow. He's afraid to come close. Well, this kind of thing goes on right on past the development of the gun. And you have sort of suicidal charges on the part of everyone. And it takes virtually several hundred years for people to get used to this, what one would call a cultural lag. I would argue that in our society now, because of communications and because the need is so much greater in terms of, you know, understanding the meaning of nuclear weapons, which I believe it's a fundamental shift in history, that cultural lag has been much quicker. Right after World War II, for instance, there's an interesting, it wasn't really a debate, but two interesting positions staked out. One by Paul Nitzer, who headed the U.S. bombing survey, and went to Hiroshima, and noticed that the trolleys were running the next day. Well, Nitzer decided, no, these things are just like big bombs. And, you know, we can use them. Bernard Brody, on the other hand, who was a famous strategist and scholar, decided and wrote pieces saying basically this was the end. This is the end. These things were too powerful to play with. Well, it turns out Brody was probably right, and most people agree now. I think probably the gradual discovery of radiation and its long-term effects had an impact. But I think that at some point, fairly recently, because there were guys like General Odom who were talking about war fighting, and the Russians were talking about war fighting too for a long time. I think finally, in the early to mid-80s, both sides have finally gotten to the point where they realize that these weapons are meant to frighten people out of ever going to war, and that essentially they shouldn't be used in that context. So that's not too bad. That's 45 years it's taken, and most of us are still alive. So that's reasonably good, I'd say. So cultural lag, although it's a phenomena and an important one, I would argue that is growing less important.
According to current conventional wisdom, the introduction of one weapon, Stinger missile, has profound political effects, and that is breaking the back of the Russian army. Some would also say the use by the Iraqis of a hitherto unused weapon, chemical weapons, had the same effects in the Iran-Iraq war. My question is this: are we going into a phase where the introduction of a new weapon, a hitherto unused weapon, is going to begin to have a real effect on terminating wars, perhaps raising new dangers?
I think in the long run, no. I think the overwhelmingly important weapon of our era are nuclear weapons. The problem with the nuclear weapons in terms of understanding them, though, is their power is so vastly out of scale with anything that a normal human being comes into contact with that it frequently allows us to forget their power. And this happens at all levels. I think it really, to some degree, happened with the military, where they talk about war fighting. If you've ever seen one of these things, a modern RV, you know, you could sit one, basically, on a chair, be about this high, be about, you know, this is Mr. Nuke, you know, it's a black, conical-shaped object. And, you know, here, you know, I could put my arm around it, you know. Yet this thing would utterly flatten Charlottesville. I mean, and really flatten it. I mean, not just, it would melt a good portion of it. things like chemical weapons and the Stinger are, in many ways, tend to be blips on the horizon. And that seems to, I say that on the basis of kind of a long-term historical judgment. When you look at the overall sine curves of weapons development. Now, the Stinger is interesting. I would argue that chemical weapons are less so. Chemical weapons actually have never been used to too much effect in combat. They're difficult to use. If the wind changes, for instance, all the stuff blows back on you. You never can really be certain of that either, wind being one of the absolute incalculables of life. Military men, essentially, when they like to plan, they like as much certainty in their planning as they can. Also, most military men just don't like that stuff. And the Iraqis, one of the difficult things of dealing with the Iraqis, though, is they're kind of out of the Western military tradition, so I can't really speak too much to, you know, their attitudes. But there seemed to be almost a certain shame on their part in using them. They would never admit to using them. You know, our government has repeatedly pounded them on that issue. And, hey, not us. No, no. They never actually used them not on their own territory. So there was a kind of they even claimed that they were not in contravention of the Geneva Accords because they did not use them offensively. The Stinger's interesting because, you know, one guy with a Stinger can knock down, you know, a Heinz helicopter costing maybe $2 million to $5 million or a fighter aircraft. And Soviets are selling fighter aircrafts now for about $14 million, and ours run up to $40 million. So that says a lot about the advantages of you know, this kind of classic confrontation between the little guy with a gun versus the enormous guy on horseback. Once again, you know, these themes continue to replay themselves at an ever higher technological level. But I think the ultimate reality is defined by nuclear weapons, and that these things just merely play at the margins.
Henry Thielberg.
And speaking of the use of military history and the development of military history, can't one differentiate with true military history and preoccupation of the past in the military establishment? I refer to, let's say, the charge of the Light Brigade came because of the prior success of that type of thing, or the Maginot Line was developed based on prior experience in the First World War, and the Russian preoccupation with the tanks was based on their on the Panzer Division type approach. So that basically we see the major failures because of preoccupation with the last war or some previous wars, which I don't know whether you would call that analysis of military history or preoccupation of the past. Or by people that didn't have a real vision into the future. So it would seem to me that if military history would be useful, but it's only useful if one can kick off from that and plan on what is likely to be in the future rather than what was in the past.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think probably the examples you cite are good examples, kind of using it poorly, except with the possible exception of the Maginot Line, which might actually have worked if they built it a little longer and hadn't extended their forces out so far. Ironically, the idea of the line, everybody said, well, they didn't build it across to Belgium. Actually, troops were supposed to stop the Germans from that avenue. And if they had been more defensive-oriented still, it might have worked, but they let themselves move further and further and further into Belgium, and the Germans cut them basically in half and then moved back behind the line. But the other examples, you know, one of the best examples, I think, is the example of the American Civil War, where virtually all the commanders in the American Civil War had served in the Mexican War, and which had been won with very confrontive tactics using smoothbore muzzle loaders, which were only accurate to about 60 yards. And in the meantime, we introduced mini ball firing, Springfields, which tripled their actually rifles and tripled the range, the effective range that a soldier could shoot at. And these guys continually were trying to use these very confrontive tactics, and everybody was getting killed. And it was very difficult for people to understand that lesson. So, yeah, I think that, you know, it in essence turns my argument on its head, and I think it's a very good point. You have to use this stuff very, very carefully. But again, I think that it is one of the major tools that we have. I mean, the future is always very uncertain. People classically rely on the past, and I guess I'd argue that, you know, you just have to use it more sensibly.
Bill Wendt.
What role would you assign to the psychology of war or wartime? All of us here, or none of us here, would able to get a feeling of gung-ho wartime conquest or anything to do with war and battle. Yet, if a war comes, you have this psychology that almost takes over. Women start producing a huge crop of babies, most of them boys. Why does that happen? And what's the consequence? The consequence is kind of a mass psychology, regardless of whether the war is what weapons or tactics it'll be fought with. Suppose, for example, that we had a new kind of Mohammed came out of the East with an irrational, fiery program of conquest and started to really look like it was going to work. And that's the sort of thing that happened. Then how does that affect, as you see it, the attitudes and the concept that war is dead?
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that the threat and the fear of nuclear weapons would still...
Well, I certainly would hope so.
Keep it dead.
That's a good point. And one of the traditional arguments against deterrence, classic deterrence, is that it protects against everything but one thing, and that's madmen. And I suppose it's difficult to categorize, you know, whole religious groups as made up of madmen, but I catch your drift. From just crazy reprisals, for instance, when in the incident with the airliner, although they do appear to have tried to blow up the captain's wife, that was long after the fact. At the time, they understood that were they to do something like import chemical weapons into New York City and set them off or something like that, that they might in fact open themselves up for some sort of horrible retribution. One would hope that wouldn't actually happen, but they seem to understand that in this world, the kind of psychology that you're talking about, a kind of overwhelming hatred that overcomes a country, is probably dangerous. Yeah,
you know,
yeah. Well, I think over time that when one looks at the American people as a fairly enthusiastic group, we've kept our heads pretty well. People are pretty calm. They don't lose their. I think there's a point which you might not want to press us, but it's pretty far from even what we've experienced. I think people are very, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, I think there were no signs that people were rioting or anything like that. In fact, I think a good example of this, I think much of this, just before World War I, in all the capitals of Europe, there was, you know, sort of open-air celebration. There's very little of that in World War II. Very little indeed. In fact, famous reporter William L. Shirer reports that even after the Germans conquered France, there was no open celebration in Germany. Quiet self-satisfaction, perhaps, but very little real enthusiasm, and some trepidations about where all this would lead to. But I think much of that spirit has been drained out of us. I remember one other example that I was just couldn't believe virtually. I was in Geneva, and we had some trouble with the Libyans right about that same time. And there was some talk that one of the places they might decide to hit was some of the U.S. delegations in Geneva. And obviously, when you're the potential target, you know, you feel a certain amount of it tends to focus the mind. And well, the United States, again, they hit Libya. And we were really quite happy that they did. And I remember we none of us spoke French too well. And we went home and watched the news on the television, and we were watching all these demonstrations. And we said, look at that, our allies are demonstrating for us. They're so happy we hit the Libyans, you know. And we found out that was quite the opposite of the case. And I think it showed perhaps that there is perhaps little enthusiasm for war in the world. Although, I mean, you make a good point. The other thing I think, a good point in that is that phenomenon that you talk about women, fertility rates going up, male births of male children going up, this kind of thing I think is not understood very well by anybody I know. And it's an interesting topic.
Reed Johnson.
Well, I'd like to go back to the question about the Stinger. And in as much as a tank attack across the east-west border in Europe is most often given as the precursor of a nuclear war, is it not technically feasible that there could be developed a defensive weapon against a tank that would be as effective as the Stinger is against aircraft, and therefore sort of render a conventional tank attack or a tank helicopter attack obviously ineffective, and put an end to what, technologically put an end to what we consider modern warfare, modern conventional warfare?
That's an interesting question, and I think there's a couple of facets to it that are all pretty interesting. I'd basically argue that's, although there's no definitive weapon against the tank, one of the problems of the Russian weapons deployment over the years has been that they've been working on the same tank armada for so long. And when one begins to see it right after World War II, it's mostly tanks. But then, well, you need infantry to support tanks, and it's pretty tough on the battlefield, so you put these guys under armor and you get these things called BMPs, infantry fighting vehicles. And somebody said, well, we're kind of worried about the aircraft, so suddenly the tanks get all these mobile anti-aircraft missiles and mobile anti-aircraft guns, and then the tank, well, you know, tanks need artillery, so suddenly you have these self-propelled artillery things that look much like tanks. Washington Post is always calling them tanks, but they're actually, as Dr. Kimball will tell you, they're actually entirely different. The point is, the tank has already had to develop a kind of armada of support vehicles, almost like the battleships did or carrier task force did. The problem with all this is they've been playing the same tune for 40 years. And the United States, which gradually, because we're moving into a new industrial period, didn't feel it was worth it to build all those tanks. So we decided at some point, with increasing enthusiasm and ingenuity, to begin to develop a series of weapons to defeat the tank. We have a plane, the A-10, which is virtually a flying gun, which shoots these machine gun bullets about this long with depleted uranium cores, making them very heavy and very dense, to punch through the top of the tanks the Soviets then have had to put things like these, what they call add-on reactive armor. So the tank begins to take on, it begins to, you know, you're literally adding more and more weight to these vehicles to try to protect them. We have anti-tank guided missiles, a variety of different types of those. We have a number of different other concepts of more advanced sort, these what are known as advanced conventional munitions. We have little self-guided bomblets that will fire from a multiple rocket launcher. What we see then is that the Soviets, I would argue, one of the core things about the Soviets developing the so-called defensive doctrine that they're talking about so much is not only because it serves a political purpose, and it very much does serve a political purpose, but it's also got some roots in actual military utility. The Soviets are worried about the survival of the tank, and they realize that if they fight, at least initially, on the defensive, it will be less vulnerable because, you can keep all that junk together. You start putting all these things out on the battlefield and having race across Europe. A lot of guys driving the anti-aircraft carriers are going to get lost or they'll get blown up, and before you know it, your tanks will be out alone, which you don't want it to happen. So, okay, we'll fight on the defensive, which I believe is an indication that the Soviets concede that the tank is under heavy duress. The other part about, there's another facet of your question I want to raise, is this concept of, there have been a lot of people who've talked about the idea that a war in Europe could remain conventional. The Russians would roll over and nobody would want to use nuclear weapons because it would essentially mean the end of the world. Well, A, I wouldn't count on it, but B, I think that the Soviets got a pretty good lesson in that when they lost their power plant in Chernobyl. Western Europe and Western Russia is dotted with nuclear power plants. Now, these things are fairly robust, at least on the U.S. side. Some of them, like the Chernobyl reactors, the containment consists of an 1/8-inch corrugated steel roof. If people were to start to either accidentally or deliberately attack these nuclear power plants with conventional weapons, you could create, in essence, the equivalent of a nuclear war. No nuclear weapons, but all the residual, even worse, actually, the breaching of a nuclear power plant creates worse radiation than you would have with an ordinary ground or air burst. So the idea of a conventional war, a kind of tank blitzkrieg across Europe, seems to me all the more far-fetched. And who knows that better than the Russians, who have had to clean up after Chernobyl?
Colonel Kimball, one of my frustrations in graduate seminars is that the best and the brightest in those seminars, and one of them is sitting behind me, sometimes never ask any questions, and I respect that. But on this subject, you know more than any of the rest of us, and you've been one of the most generous contributors to the center. If you cared to answer a question, we'd be glad to have you.
Well, one thing, I had a couple of things in mind, and one dealt a little bit with the chemical warfare. And what to my mind is the difference between chemical warfare and some others in the all-pervasiveness, if you will, of the weapon rather than a point weapon. Mm-hmm. A soldier says, this bullet is going to hit me. If you get a chemical attack or radiological, it's differentiated from nuclear. It's a little different problem. You didn't touch much on chemical warfare. And the other was, question in my mind, is your thesis of war is dead applicable only to the big guys?
Let me take the second one first. Yes, but yes for the short term, but for the mid and longer term, no. I think that because third world countries essentially tend to fight with modern weapons, I mean, they all buy Mirages and they have Exocets and all that good stuff, They do, although they're their economic base tends to be weaker, they do run into many of the same problems that one finds the so-called big guys would have in a war. Now, the only, you could call the Falklands a successful war in that the British were able to accomplish what they wanted to do, but at a surprisingly high cost to themselves. The Argentine Air Force, which was not considered to be one of the better air forces in the world, proved to be remarkably effective, very brave, very skillful. The major war, though, the key war that I think we've seen in the 80s is obviously the Iran-Iraq War, which is virtually a replay of World War I, an utter, brutal, stupid stalemate in which neither side gained a thing. Vietnam did manage to win a 20-year struggle and also managed to win itself an honored place as one of the five poorest nations on earth, with an economy that's in utterly hopeless condition. This was once a rather wealthy or potentially wealthy country. So I think that these lessons will gradually seep into the consciousness of the less developed nations. Now, in terms of your first question, the all-pervasiveness of chemical warfare, that's again a problem. There are basically two kinds of chemical weapons, persistent and non-persistent, persistent obviously lasts longer. But in both cases, you always sort of have to be ready for a chemical attack because it can kill you in just a flash. And the amount of chemical weapons that would be used is fantastically small. I mean, a tiny droplet on your hand of something like VX would kill you. One of the problems on the battlefield is that you have to continually, or almost continually, have some sort of protective equipment. Now, we've developed a rather sophisticated light kind of charcoal suit that people, charcoal kind of has activated charcoal inside of the two layers of cloth. But people have argued that all you have to do is, like, if you had some chemical weapons, you could mix it up with some sand and the explosive would blow right through the suit and you'd have the same problem. The Russians wear a big heavy rubber suit, and they sort of, somebody described it as a body condom. And these things are not much fun to wear. I mean, you have an effective combat, combat effectiveness of about an hour in these things, and you begin to get so dehydrated and tired that you're not much good on the battlefield. So it's very, very difficult to conceive of even fighting in a chemical environment. Another thing is the remarkable dislike that people have expressed for these weapons. And the example I would give is the amazing fact, again, one of the real anomalies in military history, the fact that chemical weapons were not used in World War II. Now, this was a really enthusiastic war. People were highly motivated to kill each other here, so much so that they actually used nuclear weapons. It's the first and hopefully only nuclear war in history. Yet nobody used chemical weapons. And it's even more remarkable when it was discovered, the Allies discovered to their utter horror of mortification, that the Germans, although the Allies had what are fairly conventional chemical weapons, Lewisite, mustard gas, cyanide, phosgene, the Germans had, in the interwar period, developed this new class of what are known as nerve agents. Mm-hmm. And they actually had stockpiles of these things that are 1,000 times more deadly than anything the Allies had. And we discovered this stuff after the war. The Germans never used it. Of course, they didn't exactly understand that we didn't have nerve agents, but they had no reason to believe we did. And when you look at why they didn't, well, one of the reasons is none of these guys particularly liked it. A lot of the German generals who had served in World War I didn't like fighting in that environment. And the key guy was Adolf Hitler, who was gassed in World War I and never forgot that. And so they never used it.
Before question. Yeah.
Al Fernbach and yeah, Andre Bianchi and Paul Day. Paul, you had your hand up long ago.
I'm sorry.
Paul.
Well, I have a very simple question. I wonder if you can tell us about what kind of military history is being taught at the three military academies.
Well, I really can't. Although I can take a guess, I would believe that the West Point is studying the history of great land battles, that Naval Academy is studying naval affairs, and the Air Force is studying the Allied bombing campaign here.
Yep.
No, but I think that there are people that, yes, I think they do all teach some military history. But how much and what kind is not entirely clear to me, sir. I'm sorry, I just...
Al Fernbach and then Victor Yelke.
I'm delighted with your optimism about war being dead. I wish I could fully share it. I would like to. And I want to turn to that for a moment. It seems to me your thesis is sound not on the basis simply that weapons have become so terrible, and particularly the nuclear, that war is not feasible. But one returns to the question asked by my friend over yonder a while ago about the irrationality, and one has to say that two other conditions seem to me have to exist before you can really say war is dead. And I want your reaction to these two. One, you have to have relations between states and other parties so set that alternative institutions in conflict management exist and are recognized rather than resort to war. There have to be really feasible alternatives. And secondly, for the irrational situation, you have to have not only the maintenance of weaponry to strike at that irrational source of trouble, but the will to do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, in terms of the first, conflict management, it strikes me that this is a fairly hot kind of academic topic now, peace studies. And I guess my feeling is that it's very difficult when to institutionalize mechanisms that will ensure that states do not come to blows. It seems to me much of what's taken place to stabilize the political environment has been done almost sub rosa. Deterrence is obviously the most startling example of that. On the other hand, I think it's interesting, for instance, that both France and Great Britain, especially if they go ahead and modernize their forces, will have the capability to destroy the United States. Yet, and they really will, because they'll have submarine missiles and much of the population and guts of the U.S. is located on both coasts. So they'll be very effectively capable of destroying the U.S. But I don't think we will be that concerned about them, because our basic interests and our style of government does not necessarily conflict with either of those countries. And that is a kind of informal phenomenon. And so on those grounds, I guess, and the second part was
the will to use power.
Yeah, the will to use power. Again, that I guess you really refer to terrorism. And that's really very hard. It really is. I think that what I see is like deterrence is kind of a big bridge, and kind of like the Brooklyn Bridge, if you can imagine modern day Brooklyn. And underneath the bridge, there's two like gangs, like West Side Story, fighting it out. And what do you do about that? What do you do about terrorism? It's going to be real hard
for a country like the United States to deal effectively with terrorism. There are ways to deal with terrorism. There's, you know, you can train people, you can adopt policies of very selective, discreet assassination. For instance, the idea that we had an airstrike to kill Gaddafi. You know, we sort of dropped bombs over not too large a portion, but a certain portion of Tripoli, because basically it's against the law to murder one guy. So you have to murder a number around him to kind of make it sort of accidental. And, oh yeah, he died too. However, were you to go to the other extreme and say, okay, we're going to develop a very highly sophisticated group of assassins here. We're going to deal with terrorism. We're going to nip it in the bud. That's really a problem for our democracy. It's not only a problem because it conflicts morally, but it could come to the point of threatening some of our free institutions if you create a kind of cadre of super effective individual assailants. That's a frightening thing. And I think most people in this country instinctively are repelled by that. I think there are things you can do about terrorism, but I think you have to be very, very careful as you move into this environment. And you have to be able to sort out, the gentleman over here is very, I think, pressing comments about anger. You have to be able to sort out the anger from what actual threat any particular terrorist group poses for the society as a whole. And of course, you know, enough terrorist acts and you begin the society. I mean, Italy got to the point in the 80s where I think sovereignty was really to some, not threatened, but diminished. And I was talking to a gentleman, an expert on Latin American history, and the Shining Path has actually in Peru has gotten to the point where sovereignty is becoming a joke in Peru because of terrorism. So you know, you can get to a point where it really does threaten the integrity of the society. But I think the willingness to use the kind of force that you may be implying has to be very carefully sorted out.
Victor Yonke.
I read some theories that the Russians would not fight really broad-based land war like they did the last time, huge volumes of men maneuvering, but would be a highly mobile kind of a movement, picking their spots and banging through on a different base, almost like a stupid dive bomb or panzer group.
Yeah.
Would you make any comment on that?
Yeah, I think that was their plan. But the problem with the plan was it was 40. It's 45 years old, and
I'm speaking about the future. That would be a much more mobile army and a smaller army.
Okay, you're right, and that's an interesting point. There are those that argue that they're behind the Soviets' unilateral cuts in their armament is in fact a kind of. It's kind of the devil's theory of disarmament, that what's happened is that their military scientists have come to view NATO as so cluttered, and especially, and our forces now, we've been able to finally get the kind of defense in depth that might really, really effectively slow their forces down sufficiently really to make a pretty credible defense and prevent a breakthrough. That their idea is that, well, if we can kind of clear out the battlefield a little bit, we'll fight with, you know, we'll cut our numbers, and then NATO will cut their numbers, and things will be a little less dense, and then we'll be able to punch through. Well, on certain grounds, this, you know, it makes a certain technical sense, but historically, it doesn't seem to me to be true. My feeling about the Soviet Union right now is that a series of three signal events, the first being their invasion of Afghanistan and what happened to them in that, the second being a bizarre reaction on the part of their leadership when we introduced especially the Pershing 2s, but also the cruise missiles, essentially response to their introduction of the SS-20s. I don't know if you're all familiar with it, the intermediate range missile. But they perceived that at the time that Yuri Andropov was general secretary of the CPSU as actually a threat to them that we were going to use these missiles to unilaterally attack them. And this is absolutely bizarre. And I think as the present leadership looks back on that, they see it as more and more and more crazy that they ever... And I think that's part of Glasnost, is understanding that they can never allow themselves to get that provincial and that disconnected from the thinking of the West, that they would actually literally endanger themselves. And so I think the leadership now looks at that and said, my God, you know, we thought they were about on the edge of attacking us with nuclear weapons, and God knows what they might have been planning to do. We simply don't know. But the third event was Chernobyl, and one can almost imagine Gorbachev looking at the head of the general staff and saying, look, this was a nuclear reactor, and we were thinking about nuclear war. My God, you know. So my feeling is that the Soviets have dramatically devalued military power as an end towards what they want in the European environment. If I were the Soviets, and I don't know if they're basically this radical, if I wanted to get what I wanted in Europe, this is the way I'd do it. I'd unilaterally disband the Warsaw Pact. I build a big defensive barrier across the western borders of the USSR, because I don't want to give up the Baltic republics, and I don't want anybody to think I'm ready to do that. I cut my army. I do this all unilaterally too. I cut my strategic forces to a reasonable level, and they're still very, very, very powerful. I smile at virtually everyone. I'd cut my force structure out on the Chinese border. I'd give back the Japanese the Kurile Islands. And then I'd wait for all that money to come in from European credits. And I'd watch as NATO disintegrated and the United States, from both domestic pressure and from the pressure from the Allies, was forced to leave the continent, go back to the United States. There I'd be. I'd still be enormously strong, obviously the strongest military power in Europe. I'd have gotten everything I wanted without one drop of Russian blood being shed. Now, I don't know this is going to happen, but it's conceivable it might happen. It could happen. So that, from my point of view, you know, that's my answer. What you say makes good sense from a military perspective, but from a larger perspective, I think there are other ways to get things done.
Three very quick questions. We're beyond our time, but Eric, okay. And then Chris, and then Dr. Alder.
Dr. Connell, I was intrigued by your analysis of agriculture as being one of the bases upon which war has traditionally been fought. Do you see any connection between your analysis of agriculture and war and the national liberation groups in these third world countries and their propensity to use conventional war as means to continue their quest for independence?
Eric, you always, whenever I talk to you, you always take my ideas and carry them a step further than I have. I think your question in some ways is its own answer. Yeah, I think there is, and I think it's a very insightful point, as usual. And I just leave it at that. Yeah, I think probably that the phenomenology associated with wars of national liberation is interesting because, again, you have this agricultural base in the third world. It's a great point. I'll remember it.
And remember that terrorism, when we talk about terrorism, it's not just terrorism isolated groups, it's organized almost institutions in most cases.
Chris?
I was going to say that given that armies and militaries are creatures of history, and that morale is so important to keeping militaries running, if you will. How can we somehow institutionalize a military that can adapt to a plethora of new types of weaponry that, because of its very newness and revolutionary nature, sort of impinges on the morale and cohesiveness of the military, because so much of it is built on the traditions of those particular weapons. If we're going to take, we're going to say the Air Force, no more manned bombers, we're going to use RPVs, no more main battle tanks, we're going to use precision-guided missiles. I'm just thinking of Gary Hart's book where he suggested that we get rid of all major carriers and we just have a bunch of little merchant ships all with their little VTOL aircraft. How could we somehow institutionalize a willingness to change and therefore get a more effective military, but at the same time preserve morale? And pretty much.
Well, I guess the answer is, it's a good question, Chris, and I think the answer is it's neither going to be here nor there. The military is not going to be allowed to totally define their own future technologically. But on the same token, I don't think that anybody in this country feels particularly angry or wants to say, look, we're not going to let you define any of it. That there'll be a compromise somewhere in the middle. And in large part, one of the kind of geniuses of the military is their ability to pour new wine into old bottles, to create weapons that do ultimately match their conceptions of what a weapon should be like. And I would expect that a certain amount of that will continue to go on, and that some of these that's in essence what this book is about, is setting up those paradigms and seeing how long-lasting they are. And obviously there's some possibility of projecting them out into the future. But again, second aspect of this is just one of the things I thought about in terms of when Gorbachev got rid of the tanks. There's something almost punitive about that. He's sending them a message. But those kind of things, you know, are not necessarily over time. They don't necessarily dominate. You know, I think the military will, in large part, define its own future. But again, I don't think we can allow them to do things that cost so much that we can't afford, you know, schools for our kids.
Before Dr. Aldrich asked the last question, where can we get the book?
Oh, everywhere. Yeah, that's important. Well, I know they've got lots of copies at the book gallery and at Williams Corner Bookstore, and I think Walden's and B. Dalton's also carrying it. I highly recommend it.
Dr. Aldrich?
Well, to return again to the question about the imminent mortality of war, the man's defense against overwhelming threat is the most common defense is denial that the threat exists. And the worse the threat, the greater the denial. We saw denial of the potential of the German military before World War II, which was a denial of the other person, of the extent of the other person's threat. We also saw in Hitler the denial of the recognition of the weakness of one's response towards the end of the war. How can you avoid denial of the threat that is so extreme that it, as you pointed out, can obliterate the our civilization for all intents and purposes? Is not that a dynamic that makes continuing risk of war from Pakistan or Tripoli or someone, even if the Russians and ourselves are able to avoid it?
That's an excellent question. I think a good last question too. I imagine you're aware of some of the work that Robert Jervis has done on perceptions and misperceptions in international affairs, and makes just this point that there is a tendency, I think he says, to overestimate things that are unlikely to happen and underestimate things that are very likely to happen, and that there is this tendency to deny the reality of overwhelmingly true or likely events. In that context, I think there's been shown over and over in political surveys of public opinion that there's this real tendency on the part of our public, and one would assume the Soviets too, to just thrust the whole awareness and danger of nuclear weapons just out of their consciousness. This is really dangerous. And to give you an example of how dangerous it is, I think many historians would agree that one of the great tragedies of the beginnings of World War I, which many historians believe is a sort of key event in modern history, a shattering event, is that the leadership had no idea what was about to happen to them. They didn't understand the weapons technology. They had lunatic ideas about how they might win this war. The only palliative that I see is that, and again, I would argue that in this direction, continual focus on these problems. We can never allow ourselves to become complacent. And that's just between us and the Soviets. Now, in terms of countries like Pakistan or something like that, I guess I'd argue that we always have to keep our heads and realize that we're a great deal more powerful, and just very carefully and rationally evaluate the threat. But the point is more emphasis on true knowledge, more awareness, more realism, and more attention. Like tennis players, if you don't concentrate, you can't play well. You just got a continued concentration on these issues.
You still got your battleships, and you still futzing around.